Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Larry Burns of the Council on Hemispheric Affairs, who assesses the appointment of John Negroponte as the new U.S. ambassador to Iraq. Slava Davidson, a member of the International Solidarity Movement, who discusses the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and his hope for a peaceful settlement through nonviolent collaboration between activists on both sides. And commentator Doug Ireland, who takes a critical look at the direction and strategy of John Kerry's campaign for president. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
In March 2002, Macedonia security forces killed seven undocumented Pakistani immigrants. At the time, authorities in Skopje said the Pakistanis were part of a Balkan terrorist group looking to attack vital installations. The story has now been exposed as a fraud. Officials finally admitted that the violent raid was done simply to impress the Bush administration that the government was tough on terrorism. In reality, the Pakistani immigrants were innocent. Today, the security officers, including three police commanders, face murder charges that carry a penalty of 10 years to life in jail. As current Macedonia Interior Minister Marjana Kanteska confessed to reporters, it was a monstrous fabrication to get the attention of the international community. A BBC account of the 2002 incident cites police reports stating they had found AK-47s, grenade launchers, and grenades in a van. Former Interior Minister Lulube Baskowski could be prosecuted for his role in the affair if Parliament decides to waive his immunity from criminal charges. As the Guardian newspaper observed, Macedonia, despite the deception, remains a close ally to the Bush administration, which has sent troops to Iraq. In a show of labor unrest in China's booming economy, 1,200 textile workers in the city of Suzhou peacefully blocked railroad tracks to protest the corruption of factory managers that had cost the workers nearly $25 million in pay and benefits. According to the news magazine In These Times, hundreds of Chinese police broke up the worker protests and arrested six activists for what they charged was disrupting social order. Labor advocates say that China's repression of worker rights has led to job flight from industrial zones in the U.S., Mexico, and developing nations around the globe. In March, the AFL-CIO filed a trade petition urging President George Bush to impose a tariff on Chinese goods until China agrees to enforce its own labor laws. Columbia University law professor Mark Barenberg, a consultant to the Labor Federation, claims that Chinese wages would rise significantly if minimum labor standards were enforced. He estimates that the current labor repression in China depresses factory wages anywhere from 45% to 85%. On April 28th, the Bush administration rejected the AFL-CIO trade petition. U.S. Trade Representative Robert Zolik says the Labor Federation's move would take us down the path to economic isolation. The 39 members of the Congressional Black Caucus are hoping to arrange a meeting with Ralph Nader to persuade him to abandon his independent run for president. The Hill newspaper reports that the chairman of the CBC, Representative Elijah Cummings, announced last week his group's serious concern that Nader will siphon critical votes away from the presumed Democratic Party candidate, Senator John Kerry. Nader spokesman Kevin Zeese said they'll see what the CBC has to say, but Nader still plans to run an independent campaign and doesn't want to disappoint his supporters. The longtime consumer advocates campaign has raised $600,000 and applied last week for federal matching funds. Many Democrats blame Nader for giving the White House to President Bush in 2000. Earlier this year, the Democratic National Committee chairman, Terry McAuliffe, pleaded with Nader not to enter the race. And former presidential candidate Howard Dean, who now supports Kerry, has also implored Ralph not to run. Unlike the 2000 election, where Nader was the candidate of the Green Party, this year he's running as an independent. But his campaign volunteers, who are gathering signatures to get on state ballots, have run into many barriers, including being hit with trespassing charges. Pro-Democratic groups such as America Votes, ACT, and the Media Fund have joined forces to keep an eye on Nader and keep him off state ballots. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon and Jeanette Nowak. For Between the Lines, I'm Zelfia Hunter.
In recent weeks, the Bush administration has been reeling from crisis to crisis in Iraq. Battles in the cities of Fallujah and Najaf have resulted in one of the most deadly months for U.S. soldiers and Iraqi civilians, with more than 115 American personnel and over 1,300 Iraqis dead. A ceasefire brokered in Fallujah arranged for the deployment of an all-Iraqi force in the rebellious town and was to have been led by a former Republican Guard general in Saddam Hussein's army. But that move was widely criticized by Iraqis, persecuted by the former regime, and was quickly reversed. A standoff in the holy city of Najaf between U.S. troops and a militia group loyal to Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr continues with frequent skirmishes. Meanwhile, U.S. troops have been charged with abusing and torturing Iraqi prisoners, and these reports have erupted into a major international scandal. Allegations describe the beating and sodomizing of Iraqi prisoners, which may have resulted in the death of at least one Iraqi detainee. These charges, along with photos published of American soldiers subjecting hooded and naked Iraqi prisoners to sexual humiliation, have enraged millions of Iraqis and Muslims around the globe, already vehemently opposed to the U.S. invasion and occupation of Iraq. Into this turmoil will walk John Negroponte, the newly appointed U.S. ambassador to Iraq, who is slated to take charge of the nation in July as the U.S. symbolically transfers sovereignty to an as-yet-unknown Iraqi provisional government. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Larry Burns, executive director of the Council on Hemispheric Affairs, who examines the disturbing career of Mr. Negroponte, which includes an assignment as the American ambassador to Honduras during a period of gross human rights abuses there and a U.S.-sponsored illegal war against Nicaragua.
In the first year of Negroponte's presence in Honduras, the U.S. military budget, military supplies flowing to Honduras increased from 3.5 million to approximately 77 million. And at this point, because there were dissidents in Honduras, Honduran citizens who, like Cambodia in Vietnam, next to Vietnam, did not want their country to be converted into a field for war, these people were ardent critics of the U.S. Role for Honduras, and as a result of that opposition, they became candidates for a very sinister operation known as Battalion 316, which in effect was a Honduran death squad, mainly composed of Honduran military and mufti, which systematically apprehended, tortured, and then murdered about 180 or 85 victims, opponents of the U.S. plans for their country.
What was John Negroponte's role in terms of setting up this unsinkable aircraft carrier in Honduras? We have read reports about human rights abuses by the military in Honduras towards the dissidents you just referred to, and the fact that it seems Mr. Negroponte, by some accounts, whitewashed these human rights abuses.
Very much so. In fact, at the time, in the 70s, late 70s, or maybe the early 80s, Congress passed a measure, I think it was called the Leahy Amendment, in which an annual human rights report had to be filed with Congress, be prepared by the State Department, of every country around the world that received economic assistance, military assistance from the United States. And so a report was prepared by what was known as the human rights officer in the embassy, a designated, usually junior member, junior career foreign service officer, who prepared the report. The report then went to the ambassador, Ambassador Negroponte. I believe that the human rights officer in the embassy at the time was a man named Chichester. He produced the report. He turns it over to Negroponte. Negroponte then proceeds to drastically edit the report, taking out all references to human rights violations. And then the report goes to Washington. Now, it just happened that at that time, the head of the Bureau of Humanitarian Affairs, which dealt with human rights, was a man who became even more notorious later than he was at this point, Elliot Abrams. And Abrams, according to sworn testimony, continued doctoring the Honduran report until the final draft made not a reference to human rights violations. There are no human rights violations in Honduras. Now, Mr. Chichester, who subsequently resigned from the Foreign Service, later made the comment that in reflecting upon what his report was when he drafted it to what it had become after it had been doctored by both Negroponte and Elliot Abrams back in Washington, Chichester said that the report seemed, after reading it, that it was discussing Norway rather than Honduras. There was a total gutting of the report in order for it to become a political document, because what was at stake here? If a country was ruled a human rights violator, it could not receive any U.S. military aid. So that was a very important issue at play here. Now, Negroponte didn't only commit human rights violations. He fulfilled that old bromide that the purpose of an ambassador is to be sent abroad to lie for your country. And did he lie? He lied to reporters from American newspapers and magazines, news magazines and radio reporters. He protected the U.S. position in Honduras against any kind of bad press. And he went well out of his way to invite journalists to visit Honduras, where he would apply a snow job to them in order to dispel them of the idea that there were any violations taking place in Honduras. And, of course, this was a man who was so inhospitable to Honduran democracy, and he's now being sent to be actually the pro-counsel of the U.S. Embassy in Iraq, which, of course, is far more than your traditional ambassadorial position with your ambassadorial responsibilities. This is a job in which will make him really into the Gauleiter of Iraq, the most powerful single person in that country.
Given John Negroponte's history in Honduras and with the Contra War, what concerns do you have about his role, his future role, as one of the most important U.S. diplomats in the world, operating as the U.S. ambassador in Iraq?
This perhaps sums up Negroponte in the best way possible. He's a man that the end justifies the means. He's like kind of the special forces of the U.S. diplomatic corps. You send him in when there's a tough job to be done, and no questions, no embarrassing questions need to be asked.
That was Larry Burns, Executive Director of the Council on Hemispheric Affairs. Contact the Council at area code 202-216-9261 or visit their website at www.coha.org. Members of Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon's Likud party voted overwhelmingly on May 2nd against his plan to withdraw Israeli forces from the Gaza Strip, even though polls showed a majority of all Israelis support the idea. The May 2nd killing of a pregnant Israeli settler and her four children by Palestinians was thought to have influenced the vote. A rotating group of activists who have spent time in the Palestinian territories serving as international monitors of human rights violations are traveling in the U.S. as part of what's called the Wheels of Justice Tour. The tour promotes education on nonviolence and encourages activism against war and occupation in both Palestine and Iraq. The tour bus, decorated with artwork and peace slogans, made several stops recently in Massachusetts and Connecticut. At the tour's recent stop in New Haven, Slava Davidson described two recent visits to the West Bank, where he spent 3 months over the past year, departing in March. He is a member of the International Solidarity Movement, or ISM, a group founded by a Palestinian, an Israeli, an American Jew, and a Palestinian American. Over the past 2 years, two ISM members, American Rachel Corey and Briton Tom Herndahl, were killed by the Israeli military when they nonviolently intervened to protect Palestinian homes and children. Davidson, who lives in New York City, spoke with Between the Lines' Belinda Tuhus about his observations in the West Bank and expressed hope for a peaceful settlement through collaboration between Palestinians and Israelis.
The International Solidarity Movement is a Palestinian-led organization. A number of Israeli citizens also work with the ISM. and we have on the ground at any time, we have between 30 to 300 or 400 people. But the movement is definitely Palestinian-led. Because the Palestinians take the brunt, basically any sort of repercussions for our work, we have to verify any ideas that we have to bring to the local communities that we, within which we work, to the community leadership, and say, is this okay with you guys? Is this something that you want to be doing? Because you will be the ones who get punished, for, even though we were doing, for example, clearing a roadblock. If we go in and clear a roadblock, the Israeli army may come in the next night and raid the town.
I was in South Africa the last 2 weeks of March, and I was there. I covered a demonstration on March 20th. A few days later, Ahmad Yassin was assassinated by the Israelis, and it was interesting because in all the media, not just the left wing or anything like that, the left wing press, it was just the major media constantly referred to him as the spiritual advisor of Hamas. Obviously, that's not the way he was portrayed here in the U.S., and I'm sure that spiritual advisor maybe didn't cover all of what he did, but it was just interesting to see a perspective being in another country when that happened. How did you find the spirits of the Palestinian people? Because you were also there then when Sheikh Yassin was assassinated.
Correct, yeah. There was definitely a general uproar about it. There was a lot of people were just completely disgusted and completely very, very upset at what has happened, because Yassin had spent a number of years in the Israeli jail. And one of the points that a lot of the Palestinians were trying to make is that if the Israeli army wanted to get Yassin, they could have just arrested him. And they did not have to kill him. And mind you, the killing was completely illegal under all international law. The policy of assassinations is completely illegal. There is nothing illegal about randomly killing people without a trial. I mean, there is a reason why this Israel as a democracy is supposed to has this court system, which is supposed to try terrorists for their crimes. And there is no reason why the Israeli army couldn't have just gone in, taken him away overnight, and went right out. They do this all the time, and there is really nothing preventing them.
I don't know how much it's grown lately, but I know, because I haven't heard about it lately, but I know it was in the news a lot, like last year, that a number of Israeli reservists, and then recently, I guess, some pilots, said that they would refuse to serve in the occupied territories, either the Gaza Strip or in the West Bank. Are you able to make common cause with them, and would that make a difference, do you think, in terms of trying to reach some kind of just settlement?
I have spoken with a number of the Israeli refuseniks, actually. They're really amazing people to speak with, especially the young guys who are 18, 19, and they have the guts, and not just the brains to do it, but also the guts to really stand up and say, no, I'm not going to go serve in the territories. This is completely wrong. This is not in the interest of Israeli security. The settlements have nothing to do with the security. The wall has nothing to do with security. And it's really amazing because a lot of them are really vocal and standing up, and they do face jail. It's pretty much a choice between either you go into the army or you go into jail, and they will get 6-month sentences, which will get repeated again and again until they either say, I'm going to serve, or the Israeli army just says, we don't want to deal with you. But they're really, really amazing people, and I think that's the way forward for the Israelis, I think, in a lot of ways, because I think there does need to be a movement within Israel that says, no, this is not in our name, this is wrong, this has nothing to do with security, we want real security, we want real social services. And the fact is, you know, when you start talking about security, one of the problems with the settlements, one of the problems with the Israeli policy is that it has been draining the Israeli economy. And right now, I just read an article in the Haaretz the other day, 30% of the Israeli children live under the line of poverty at this point. 30%. That number has skyrocketed over the past few years because of the amount of money that has been put into settlements and the amount of money that's gone into the wall. And Israel is literally running out of money for their security, quote-unquote, which really has nothing to do with security as such.
Since you came back, there was this visit by Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon to visit Bush in the White House. And after that, Bush approved of this plan to unilaterally withdraw from the settlements from Gaza, I guess, but not to, in fact, withdraw from the West Bank and to accept the Israeli position that the right of return, the Palestinian right of return, doesn't exist. Are you aware, even though you haven't been there physically since early April, what kind of impact this has had on the Palestinian struggle?
I'm not sure how much of an impact that has really made. As far as withdrawing from Gaza, the thing about the withdrawal in Gaza is that, yes, you may pull out the settlements, you may pull out the army, but the army is still going to be controlling the borders. It's still going to be controlling the airspace, it's still going to be controlling the access to water and the border with Egypt. It's just all it's going to be is just a giant jail.
That was Slava Davidson of the International Solidarity Movement, traveling with the Wheels of Justice Tour. For more information about the tour, call area code 773-505-1870. Or visit their website at www.justicewheels.org. As Massachusetts Senator John Kerry tours the nation and raises funds in his race for the White House, there are growing doubts about the direction of his campaign. Many Democratic Party activists and political observers note that the presumed Democratic Party nominee has yet to find a clear or compelling message for his campaign. There is also concern in recent weeks that the Bush administration has succeeded in putting Mr. Kerry on the defensive about his tax policies, his support for the military, and his war record. Despite deepening violence and instability in Iraq, harsh questions about what the White House knew about possible attacks before 9/11 and a succession of scandals, Mr. Bush is holding his own or gaining ground in recent public opinion polls. Some critics of the Kerry campaign say his early support for the Iraq War and later contradictory positions make it difficult for the candidate to differentiate himself from the president. Others point out that Mr. Kerry's pro-corporate economic platform, designed to appeal to moderate voters, will fail to motivate the party faithful in numbers large enough to win in November. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with New York-based commentator Doug Ireland, who takes a critical look at the direction and strategy of John Kerry's campaign for president.
John Kerry voted for the blank check that shredded the Constitution and gave away the separation of powers between that reserved to the Congress the right to declare war and handed it to Bush to invade Iraq on any basis and whenever he liked. John Kerry is now hobbled by that vote and does not dare really express much dramatic difference with Bush policy in Iraq, because if he did, he'll be accused of being a waffler and the Republicans will simply point to what the way Kerry voted in authorizing the war and to what he said at that time. It will play into the general portrait of Kerry as a guy who says whatever people want to hear at the moment they want to hear it, but is inconsistent in his views. So Kerry really basically has had only one thing to say about Iraq that was any different from what the Bush administration is saying, and that was that the occupation of Iraq had to be internationalized. But Bush took that issue off the table, basically, when he agreed to hand over the choice of the new Iraqi government, whom power will be allegedly handed over in 2 months at the end of June. And Bush embraced UN Special Envoy to Iraq, Lakhdar Brahimi, as the man who now is picking the new government for Iraq. Absent that difference, Kerry has very little to say on Iraq that is very different from what George Bush is saying. He's already said, Kerry has, that he's in favor of sending more troops to Iraq. So there's very little difference there. And that's a serious problem when you have an opposition party that doesn't behave like an opposition party and whose leader is basically hobbled and handcuffed by his own record. It also creates a considerable opening, which Ralph Nader is trying to take advantage of by rather belatedly proclaiming himself the anti-war candidate and calling for a U.S. pullout from Iraq. I happen to think that Ralph has made a terrible mistake by running for president this year, because I think that as lousy as John Kerry may be a candidate, that George Bush absolutely has to be defeated. He's a great danger to the world. But Kerry, in his inability to distinguish himself from Bush on Iraq, is creating an opening whereby Nader may well be able to pull enough votes in enough key states to hand the election to George Bush.
Doug Ireland, you write about triangulation and the use to which that was put by the Clinton campaign in both 1992 and 1996. Does the idea of attracting moderate voters and co-opting some key Republican issues not make sense in 2004 as it might have for Clinton when he ran for president?
Well, I think it's not only wrong from a moral point of view to scamper to the right and in a fruitless search for Republican and pro-corporate votes. I think it's a political error, an electoral error. Unless you mobilize the Democratic base, you're not going to beat George Bush. And Kerry has nothing to say on the economy that is different from what George Bush is saying in any substantive way. Bush has a very appealing false populist slogan: cut taxes, they work. And has a very very simple message on the stump painting, government is the enemy of the people. To this, John Kerry says, well, I'm for different tax cuts, including corporate tax cuts.
Given the crisis that many insiders and outsiders see the Kerry campaign in right now, is there time to recover in the 6 months or so before the election?
There might be time, but we don't see any evidence that there's a capacity to do so on the part of Kerry and the people who are running his campaign. For example, I just got a look today at the two new Kerry campaign spots that he's spending $25 million, probably the largest single one-time ad buy ever for a presidential candidate. They're bio spots, basically on John Kerry's Vietnam War record, with very little substance to them. The Kerry campaign theme, which is we can build a stronger America together, is so empty and so vapid and so meaningless that it's unlikely to convince people to walk away from President Bush.
Doug Ireland, if you were to suggest a theme for the Kerry campaign, what would it be? What are Americans yearning to hear from an opposition candidate running against a president whose policies are certainly vulnerable to question, if not out-and-out ridicule?
Striking at the bane of corporate power that is a stranglehold through money on the political process is an essential component of a mobilizing campaign. If Kerry does not begin to do that, I do not see how he can win this election, particularly since the economy is not going to do badly enough to give the Democrats an advantage in November.
That was commentator Doug Ireland, whose work regularly appears in The Nation magazine and the LA Weekly. Read Ireland's recent piece on John Kerry, titled All Profile, No Courage, online at www.tompaine.com. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, or would like a recording of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Bill Cosentino, Hank Hoffman, Zelfia Hunter, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Jeanette Nowak, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.